You are listening to KGVM 95.9 FM Bozeman Community Radio and streaming at kgvm.org. Well, hi, Gallatin Valley and online listeners. This is Desert Oracle Radio Replay, and I'm your host, Roxana. Our family continues celebrating graduations and family get-togethers in these busy times of May and June. So you're in store for some double features. First up, here is the newest episode from Ken Lane, released May 11th, 2026. It's the Pentagon's latest UFO files.
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California, now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Night has fallen on the desert, and if you love flying saucers and stories of Martians and moon men and all that, maybe you've been following the release of the latest batch of government UFO files. The worst thing about these document dumps is that much of the information is media slop, often deliberate hoaxes. And this stuff was sent to whatever bureau or military branch. And very few people can distinguish that stuff from reports produced by military and government personnel. Concerned citizens would send in articles from their local paper or the National Enquirer and the Weekly World News. All kinds of wacky and wild stories, weird, wild stuff, some built around a few crumbs of reality, and many outright inventions. It gets a file number, and into the vaults it goes. That was the idea with the X-Files TV show. All the paranormal junk, the tabloid reports of werewolves, etc., went into the X-File cabinet, the stuff that wasn't assigned to anybody or any office. Why X? Because according to the TV show's lore, the unsolved file cabinet under the letter U was completely full. The response from the online fans of flying saucers has not been positive. Because the fans of space alien disclosure will only be satisfied by government confirmation of their wildest fantasies of interstellar insect armies and Ra from Egypt being a space priest demon from outer space and all that. There's just no real-world evidence for any of that stuff, as enjoyable as it might be on a movie screen or a video game. And all of those far-out, out-there concepts were brought to life by pulp magazine editors and writers and early science fiction authors, by fantasy writers, mostly working in Hollywood and Los Angeles. L.A. had a lot of people like that. They used to meet at Clifton's Cafeteria in downtown for long lunches where they talked for hours about novels and progress, hoped for Hollywood gigs, evil publishers, and all their wild visions of the future. Ray Bradbury was part of that. Robert Heinlein, too. Harlan Ellison, Aldous Huxley, Edgar Rice Burroughs, Forrest Ackerman, Octavia Butler, L. Ron Hubbard, L. Frank Baum. They all lived in L.A. For most of them, it was the most productive years of their writing career. Even Philip K. Dick was just down the road in the 70s and 80s. In the heart of the Southland, in Orange County, first Fullerton and then Santa Ana, right by Disneyland. Alongside that, a flowering of futurism, spaceships, light speed travel, alien civilizations. There were the real currents of the strange and mysterious in our world, as always, through our history, and especially prehistory. Some people sometimes witness weird and interesting things. When pre-industrial Europeans saw the mysterious orbs flying through the fields and forests, they considered it part of the fairy world, along with ghosts and little people. The trickster illusions recorded by every culture, part of myth and religion. This is the real stuff, in that some people have these experiences. But, like in the old fairy tales about the leprechaun giving you gold coins, but it's only dry leaves when you open up your hand. It's some mystery mix of illusion, suggestion, and real emotional response. Because you have had contact with the supernatural, the divine. But you can't even take a picture of it, which is why thousands of people every year see something that is not an airplane, or a drone, or a bird, or all the other things they say it definitely wasn't. And some of these people still encounter monsters, Bigfoot and Mothman and the gang, each with their own local lore. Elves and dwarves and tall Nordics and the Greys, that whole cast of characters. Yet we have no evidence for any of it beyond the experiences, beyond the stories we tell, which are important, crucial to our lives, our cultures, our moral framework, all of that. But what is the government supposed to do about such reports? If a military pilot or a ship captain logs a strange experience or sees something weird on their imaging monitor? Yes, it will be investigated.
Desert Oracle Radio.
People will show up from headquarters. They will review the backup drives, go over the logs, do some interviews, look for an actionable threat angle. And once you clear that primary goal, see what the intelligence angle is, the way the CIA collected Soviet Union tabloid articles about UFOs for decades, that's generally the end of the investigation. Maybe that tabloid report of a Martian spaceship was cover for a Soviet satellite launch. Maybe it's a cover for some Soviet atrocity. When there are mystery drones flying around military bases in the United States, those of us who like weird stories might think of UFOs. But the military intelligence agencies are always thinking about China. Let's match this up. Oh, that's right. It's this company in this province. Otherwise, what do you do with a report, especially from a civilian, about somebody who saw something that was weird? Somebody saw something go by. What was it? Somebody had a fantastic experience in a field somewhere. Okay, I buy that. I believe such things. But what is the government supposed to do about it? I've seen a few things that have no rational explanation, not to me, and I'm fairly well-versed in the constellations and the planets and the phases of the moon and atmospheric conditions and Starlink rocket launches from Vandenberg and military flares over 29 palms and all that. I have even had at least one experience that fits the classic encounter. The classic encounter as described in ancient Greek epic poetry and the Holy Bible and the X-Files, too. There's no form I can fill out, no certificate I can get from Washington to make such stuff legitimate or scientific. It just is. One thing I did enjoy about this UFO document dump was some smarter-than-usual cultural reports, like how the paranormal prankster Gray Barker largely invented the Men in Black meme. And his paranormal writer friend, John Keel, a notorious trickster himself, then promoted the idea. Especially in his best-selling book, The Mothman Prophecies. John Keel and Gray Barker created the Men in Black from a mix of mostly real incidents and their own paranoid fantasies. Usually from a creepy story about a plainclothes FBI man in that basic dark anonymous business suit snooping around after a local UFO flap made the papers, hit the wire services. The black suit, or dark blue or dark gray suit, was the uniform that nearly all white-collar men wore to work from the late 1940s through the mid-70s. When the basic standards of office wear collapsed into hippie-influenced polyester atrocities. White collar comes from the white dress shirt collar visible atop the dark suit jacket, as opposed to the blue collar, which was often sweaty and grimy, being the collar on the working man's neck. Blue was the common color of laborer overalls, coveralls, of blue jeans, which used to be worn by miners, mechanics, etc. Until they became fashionable, and blue jeans became the universal pants. Until the 1980s, anyway, when a decade-long return to suits and ties and Ivy League preppy clothing buried the hippie culture and hippie couture. John Keel himself is the man in black at the beginning of the Mothman book. It's a great setup. That book is a trip, as we used to say in California. Part of the new batch of flying saucer files, while mostly familiar to UFO fans who've had versions of most of these documents and pictures for decades, is the UFO futurism summary, which concludes that many science fiction and space opera fantasy concepts appear nearly unchanged in the UFO reports that followed. This fits nicely into the science fiction ideal of dreaming up our real future, but with the weirdly helpless belief of the UFO cultists that only these godlike secret space aliens have such futuristic aerospace craft and other magical technology. This is what makes most UFO believers simply believers in old-fashioned religion and folkloric belief. They ascribe godlike powers and sci-fi magic tech to an unseen, recently made up by us, hidden society of super beings from outer space. And as a result, these people allow themselves no creative ambition of their own. They don't desire to build a UFO like the Skunk Works or SpaceX guys do for fun for their work. Instead, the UFO faithful just have a belief about some higher beings that have magic machines. Plus another layer of belief in a priestly class, men in black, intelligence agency directors, UFO influencers on YouTube and podcasts. And this priestly class mediates the flying saucer experience. They are between the higher power, the aliens, the non-human intelligence, whatever they call God now, and on the other side, the faithful. It's identical to the role of priestly mediators between people and gods found in every ancient religion. But because widespread religious illiteracy is the hallmark of our secular age, most UFO believers don't realize they are traditionally religious people. Thinking about metaphysics in traditionally religious ways. So if you're looking over the UFO files material, remember that it's mostly reports and newspaper clippings forwarded to the various bureaus and military intel agencies and sometimes members of Congress. Usually with a scrawled note from an overworked office agent or secretary, something like, FYI, picnickers report seeing a flying disc over such and such lake in Florida. Newspaper article attached. Most of it's junk. Like in the X-Files, where the FBI dumped all this generally useless stuff from UFO newsletters and tabloid news stories. Because it's got to go somewhere, and there's no further action required. But you can't ever throw anything away. The goal of anyone who works beneath a pile of vague reports is get the right rubber stamp and get that stuff out of the inbox and into the to-be-filed stack. This is Desert Oracle Radio. Soundscapes by Red, Blue, Black, Silver.
...1947 was a very strange year in America, especially. In 1947, among other things, it was the beginning of the flying saucer UFO panic initially. And eventually the whole culture of flying saucers and UFOs. We're still living in a 1947 world today. I'll tell you three people who were born in 1947. Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, Donald Trump. They're all the same age. Joe Biden was born 30 or 40 years before that. No, he was born 2 years, I think 2 years before that, 45. So it seems like another world. The first jets were being flown. Modern telecommunications, such as television in homes, was starting to become common. And in August of 1947, there was a press conference at one of the social clubs in Los Angeles, and it was attended by the wire services, United Press, Associated Press, Los Angeles Times, Herald Examiner. And the claim was that a doctor, Dr. Bruce Russell, he was a primary physician, as we say now, medical doctor. He had moved out from Ohio, like a lot of people did in those days, to get out of the cold winters, the gloominess. And like a lot of people who came west, Dr. Russell fell in love with the desert. And the whole outdoor recreation industry had not yet really formed. So people did different things in the desert, things like mining, like making mining claims and digging with a shovel. I was thinking about that the other day when I was digging this little trench for the gas line here. That people for fun would load up a pick, an axe, a shovel, blankets, canteens, and they would go to the desert to look for gold or silver or whatever. Mostly it was just to get out of the house. A few people ever found anything. So this guy, Dr. Russell, was digging around by Wingate Pass, south into the Panamint Mountains in Death Valley. So he's mining, digging, he's trying to dig a mine shaft into these alluvial sands. And he's near, if you know the area, Wingate Pass, which is the south side of the Panamint Mountain Range. And while he's digging, he slips, and a sort of sinkhole opens up, and he falls. 3 or 4 feet is not bad. But he notices there's a carved out incline. So he slides down there and he starts walking. Because once he's down to the bottom, it opens up into very tall, carved, open sort of hallways in the rocks. So he's got his hurricane lamp walking through, and he sees, as he claims later, implements of a civilization, tools and things like that. And then he comes around and there's a little carved niche in the rock next to him. And laid out there are some interesting bones, bones from mammoths and saber-toothed cats, animals that were common until 12,000 or so years ago. And as he goes down, he finds a big chamber that's opened up. And at that point, he's running out of light, running out of fuel in his lantern. He turns around and goes back. This was 1931, supposedly. In 1946, he teamed up with a guy named Daniel Bovey, who had been working on digs of the cliff houses in the southwest, the Four Corners area. They went in better equipped, and according to their tale, which was told at this press conference on August 4th of 1947, there were something like 180 square miles of caverns under Death Valley. And at least in the section they went through, they had been carved out to accommodate very tall people. And they finally reached something like a chamber. The chamber was about 30 feet tall. It had a long wooden table in the center of it. And there were mummies there, some seated upright, others on the sides, all wearing what they described as tailored animal hide outfits. and there was a bunch of gold. There were weapons, and the weapons were either made of like electrum, partially gold, or had gold highlights all over them, decorative parts, axes, swords, and so forth. So they had this press conference to get some interest from the Smithsonian to buy this great discovery from them for a couple of million dollars, which is a lot more money in 1947 than now. Now that's a condo in San Diego. You could live like a king for a couple of million in 1947. And they estimated the treasure was worth $5 billion. Just from the gold. Well, the Smithsonian said they weren't interested. So they went to the Southwest Museum, which Gene Autry was a big part of. It's right by Griffith Park in Los Angeles. All kinds of cowboy, Native American, old California Republic stuff. But when they went back to show their hopeful new buyers from the Southwest Museum, there had been numerous flash floods that very wet winter, and they could not find the entrance again. But the story did not die there, although it was sort of quickly forgotten in the 40s. There was so much other stuff going. It was in July of 1947 that the flying saucer boom started with the reports that a private pilot and businessman named Kenneth Arnold up in Washington State, as he was flying over the Cascades, he was looking for a wrecked U.S. military cargo plane. There was a reward for whoever located it because it was filled with military stuff. But the story got repeated. It got repeated in a couple of books. And it ended up being on TV. It was mentioned in the old Western called Death Valley Days. It was a petty criminal who had got stuck in California state prison again. He was watching the TV. And he remembered this story about these caverns under Death Valley. The springs and underground rivers. The prisoner was Charles Manson. And this story made a very big impact. After the August of 1969 murders in Los Angeles, Charles Manson and members of his family departed for a place that's now known as Barker Ranch, or the ruins of Barker Ranch, south end of the Panamints, 5 miles from Wingate Pass, which is where the opening of the ancient civilization caves had supposedly been.
We've reached the bottom of the hour, and you are listening to Desert Oracle Radio Replay, broadcasting on KGVM 95.9 FM, Bozeman Community Radio, streaming at kgvm.org. This next one carries the theme of a holiday week. Have you heard of this one? From May 24th, 2019, here is Snakesgiving Day week.
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California, now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Night has fallen on the Mojave Desert. our majestic and strange desert wilderness, home sweet home. And nothing makes a house or a cabin or a mobile home or a yurt or a sleeping bag or whatever you call home. Nothing makes it feel like home like celebrating our wonderful desert holiday. A holiday so nice we celebrate it twice. I'm talking about Snakesgiving. Snakesgiving. Once when the snakes come out, once when the snakes go back down in the ground for their long winter's nap. Snakesgiving, as Hemingway wrote, is a movable feast because it depends upon which part of the desert you call home. Down in the low desert, Snakesgiving comes as early as Valentine's Day, usually by St. Patrick's Day, depending on elevation, longitude, latitude, whether it was a good rainy season or a dry year or a very dry year. So you never really know what you are going to get. Except you are going to get some snakes at some part of the year, some time of the year, if you are lucky enough to live in or near the desert wilderness. Lucky you. You're in luck. I was talking with an old friend not long ago, and this person said something along the lines of, "Don't you get bored out there? Don't you miss the city?" And I said, "Of course, I miss some elements of civilization at some times. And because I'm not under house arrest at the moment, I can just visit the nearest city or large town whenever I want, within reason. Once or twice a year, if I have to. The truth is, no matter where we live, these days a lot of us tend to live pretty much exactly the same wherever we are. The same lives, more or less. No matter where we are, no matter how unique the place we occupy. Now, people get most of their entertainment through the same cable channels and television services plans, and they look at the same boring internet. The same boring social media, and they tend to live in places that look pretty much the same in and out across most of the country, most of the continent, most of the modern world. And you can do that in the desert, but it's a lot harder to pull that off when you live on a couple of acres of Joshua trees and creosote, and there are baby quail popping through your garden and great horned owls hooting at night and hummingbirds zipping around the cactus blossoms and Mojave cottontails munching on what's left of the wildflowers. and that old desert tortoise chewing thoughtfully on a patch of half-green something or other. Tortoise lettuce, some people call it. Now, just the other night, over the Bartlett Mountains, I saw some brilliant orange lights. It was dusk, and there was just a little bit of light left in the sky, and then there were a few more orange lights, and a few more. Now, a lot of people visiting out here see something like that, and they lose their minds. It's a UFO! Go get your phone off the patio table and try to get some pictures of it. They will be very impressive pictures. Each light, one or two pixels, and a sea of darkness and digital noise. Well, these lights were pretty easily identified. You spend some time out here and you come to know the marine base flares, which they drop from aircraft to light up the desert below where a bunch of 18-year-old kids are running around with machine guns in the dark pretending to kill people. Sometimes they succeed. It's military training. Very important. But the flares sure look pretty, just hanging there in the sky for a few minutes, looking like you could touch them if you were standing on that mountaintop, which is not very far away. And while standing outside enjoying this light show, I heard a very close owl doing his hoo-hoo, and then looking around, I saw the silhouette of a great horned owl up on the telephone pole on the roadside. Well, I watched it for about 20 seconds, and then it lifted off the top of the pole. Those great wings opened up, and it swooped down, disappeared. Swoop, swoop. Sometimes they'll let you watch them. But as they're watching you long before you see them, I get the feeling the owls don't really enjoy being stared at, like they were some sort of attraction. Anyway, the snake report so far in this so far still cool and occasionally rainy late spring now totals only 2 snakes. On my daily walks that transpire in many different areas where you can walk out among the rocks and the Joshua Tree woodland, the high desert. The first of my snake season was a nice, nutty brown gopher snake. Tawny brown, I guess. Better camouflage than some of the brighter yellow gopher snakes I usually see around here. This one was 3+ feet long. I nodded hello and it ignored me. A perfect relationship, really. 2 things sort of telegraph that a gopher snake is not a rattlesnake, and they are things worth remembering. 1, the real proof that you need is that rattlesnakes have larger, triangular-shaped heads, spade-shaped. Some species even have horns, just like the devil. But these snakes, unlike that oddest angel created and empowered by the god of various popular religions, these snakes mean you no harm. They are not going to try to trick you. You are too big for them to eat, so you are of no concern to the snake unless you scare it or threaten it or accidentally step on it. other clue, mostly based on personal experience of walking amongst the venomous and non-venomous snakes during our half-plus year of snake season, relates to the usual response to humans or other large creatures. The classic rattlesnake move is defensive and threatening. You can't count on it, but it is one way you will immediately know what you're dealing with. Now, whether it's a precautionary half rattle as it gets out of the way, or a determined series of sharp, loud rattles as it makes clear that it is not going to get out of the road or the trail, or off your patio, etc., the rattler has evolved these abilities to warn off threats. The rattler, when you think about it, is at a distinct disadvantage when confronted with a human. It has no legs, it has no arms, it has no hands to strangle you with. It has no hands or fists to beat you bloody. No vocal cords to scream and yell. Instead, it can bite and it can sink venom right into your bloodstream. An amazing thing to see, which I've seen a few times, is the convincing impersonation of a rattler that a threatened gopher snake can perform. Its tail will start rapidly shaking against whatever leaves or grass or dead wildflowers or crumbling plaster and an abandoned structure. And it will coil in the way that a rattler will coil before striking. And the little gopher snake head will dart around like it's got a mouthful of venomous fangs. Sometimes. But rattlesnakes do not always coil before they strike, and they do not always hiss before they strike, and they do not even always rattle before they strike. The situation may have some familiar elements, but it also may be a new twist on the old game. The old game of having your ancient instincts take over immediately. When your reptilian brain recognizes that first half beat of the rattle. The only other snake I've seen so far this spring up here in the high desert was a very beautiful California king snake. I saw it on a side trail, its tail sticking out of one end of a snake hole, and its head sticking out of the other, before it went back inside because I walked by. It was underneath a little borage bush. This king snake was probably 2.5 feet, maybe 3 feet, I'm guessing mostly based on the size of the head and the tail, because the rest was out of sight. Beautiful black and white rings on the parts I saw, wide rings the width of a good onion ring, as John Muir wrote. I hope you have a happy Snakesgiving. Happy Snakesgiving to us all, everyone. Except for Let's be charitable. Happy Snakesgiving, everyone. Let's turn to the Desert Oracle news desk. We've got some news on the Cadiz Water Project. And I love to give everybody equal time here. It's not like some channels, like some stations. So I'm just going to read it right off the Cadiz press release, which was delivered to me by courier. Thanks, Cadiz. Yesterday, the California State Senate passed Senate Bill 307 by a vote of 21 to 11 with 6 abstentions. The legislation will now move to the California State Assembly for consideration in committee prior to any floor debate. The company issued the following statement regarding the Senate vote. Let's see here. California continues to suffer from long-term water supply and housing shortages and solutions. These two critical problems depend on infrastructure improvements that are increasingly difficult to come by. Bills like SB 307, as presently drafted, will make solutions tougher to sitting precedent, disregarding long-standing Cadiz Water Project, quote, project. Project has already undergone a However, we have supported and agreed to additional upfront review of science if it will provide more public and legislative confidence in our project. And so look, these are the people who want to drain the Cadiz aquifer beneath Mojave Trails National Monument and Mojave National Preserve, and pipe the water to Orange County for their swimming pools. And then all the animals in the Mojave who depend upon that water will die. Now, you may be aware that Joshua Tree businessman Brendan Mays had been hoping to sort of ride these coattails and create a new flavored beverage from water that would leak out of the Cadiz pipes. Well, as it seems like this project may finally be dead in the water, as they say, I figured we'd get Brendan on the line and see how he is coping. Well, he's got a backup plan.
Basically, our mitigation plan is dilution. So, and there's also filtration. So it's kind of a two-pronged approach, dilution and filtration. As long as we can get the levels, the parts per billion levels of the hexavalent chromium 6 below a certain amount, well, then the water is good to go. And I'm pretty sure that we can do that. I think the federal standard is somewhere around 6 parts per billion, or in California, it's 10, they're a little stricter. But we can, you know, play with the amounts until we get to an acceptable level that's not going to cause any problems. We're not too concerned about that. Environmentally devastating is kind of a pejorative way to look at it. It seems to me a little jaundiced way to look at it. We're not so sure about that kissed by the sun line. The Sunkissed Corporation out there in Thousand Oaks has threatened us. They make a lot of flavored beverages themselves, and they kind of warned us about that kissed by the sun thing. So we're going to try to take a slightly different tack. Yes, we're going to say it's eco water, sort of kissed by the sun, blessed by the sun. You're going to say blessed by the sun or purified by the sun, because big part of our plan is this entire operation is going to be, in terms of power, is going to be completely off the grid. It's all going to be solar powered. And part of our, the mitigation process of cleaning this water, that's all going to be powered by the sun. So we're thinking about having it called either blessed by the sun or purified by the sun. But we're going to really try to play up, the elemental nature of what we're dealing with here, the elemental nature of earth, wind, and fire. Wait, hold on a second. The elemental nature here, the sun, the air, and the water. I mean, those are the kind of elements we're really trying to push. Now, we had originally come out with the desert bighorn sheep as our symbol because we think that's the most iconic, the most bold, the most arresting image that we could use. It's a very strong and powerful image. As you know, Dodge trucks have been using it for years, and it's done really well for them. So we thought it could do pretty good for us. And because I drive a Dodge Ram truck myself, 3500 series, with the Cummins diesel and the Detroit Allison transmission, it's a great truck. I love that truck.
Talk to me a little bit about the flavorings and the sourcing for these so-called natural desert ingredients.
Well, we've got a few sources. We have a few flavors that we're working out right now. We've got one, Joshua Tree Flower, which is a very light, sweet flavor with hints of citrus and cinnamon. It's really a delightful flavor, not too complex, and pretty light on the palate, very refreshing. Another flavor we're dealing with is Desert Sage, which is another refreshing, palate-cleansing sort of flavor. Yeah, another flavor we're working with is surprisingly creosote, which is, you wouldn't think would have a good flavor to it, but it's actually kind of complex and smoky and leaves a really pleasant kind of caramel aftertaste. So those are the three flavors we've been working at. But we're exploring all things. There's a lot of flavors out in the desert, I'm sure, that we haven't even tried.
Can you tell me about your sourcing for these flavors, Joshua Tree? And are you harvesting these in the wild? Do you have permits?
I don't know how deep I should... I'm not really at liberty to say, Ken, exactly how we're coming up with these flavors because, again... people have heard about this project and they're all up in arms and they're ready to jump all over us. So I don't really want to say how we're getting these flavors or how we're collecting them. Suffice it to say that as a landowner and Airbnb operator in Mojave for years and years now, I have a lot of properties. I have a lot of naturally occurring specimens all over these properties, which I'm free to do with as I want, as long as I'm cutting down trees to get this stuff. I'm just harvesting nectar. But let's just say that it's all legal and it's all above board. What we're trying to do here with Mojave Mirage Beverages is we're trying to take the natural goodness and purity of the Mojave Desert, which all the locals know and enjoy, and bring it to the attention of the entire world in the form of a refreshing beverage that has none of the negative health effects that soda pop has or that these energy drinks have. We are trying to bring the goodness of the desert and spread that around the entire world at a price point that is attractive so that as many people that can never actually make it out here can get at least a little taste of the desert.
From Amboy to Zizix and across the great Mojave Wilderness, this has been Desert Oracle Radio, and I am your host, Ken Lane. We broadcast from KCDZ-FM in Joshua Tree and on fine community radio stations up and down the West Coast through Public Radio Exchange, PRX. And of course, there is a podcast available freely wherever you get your podcasts. Try telling your phone, play Desert Oracle Radio. It works sometimes. Or listen to the program on your Apple TV or tell your NSA-approved internet-connected home device, play Desert Oracle Radio. And please opt out of 24-hour surveillance. But the only way you really opt out of 24-hour audio surveillance is by throwing all those eager listening devices in the recycling bin. Throw your phone in there, too, while you're at it. Enjoy life for a change while you still can. If you are out enjoying the desert wildlands this weekend or anytime, really, bring along some water, maybe a hat, maybe tell somebody where you're going. You know, I was up in Nevada, up in Lincoln County on a expedition the other day, and to my great surprise, the whole drive from Clark County to Alamo now has cell phone coverage pretty much the whole way, and that's no fun. People were calling me. But if you're off the road a bit, you can bet you will not have cell phone coverage when you need it most. Amboy Crater eats a couple of tourists per year these days, so give a hoot and maybe you'll come home alive. Who knows? It's all part of the fun, of course. We'll meet again next week, I hope, and in the meantime, enjoy your issue 8 of Desert Oracle, our finest little field guide so far, maybe. Hang in there, international subscribers. You know how long it takes for the boat to get from the Mojave to Italy or Spain. Thanks to Red Blue Black Silver for the soundscapes made for this very program. Visit him at his house, redblueblacksilver.com. Visit us, if you must, at desertoracle.com. Thank you for listening, and good night from the voice of the desert.
Our background today is brought to you from the Axtell Bridge Fishing Access Site. Well, thanks to Red, Blue, Black, Silver and to Ken Lane for sharing their work on Desert Oracle Radio. Thanks to all the volunteers, supporters and underwriters that support KGVM. And remember, I'd love to hear from you. You can leave a text or voicemail for me at 406-404-6246. That's my Google Voice number. So leave a text or voicemail and I will get back to you. What are you reading this summer? You can leave me a message about that. Well, this program broadcasts on the air at 95.9 FM. Bozeman Community Radio, or you can stream it online at kgvm.org at 7 Sunday nights and 9 Monday mornings. Our past Desert Oracle Radio replay episodes are archived for you on the kgvm.org website. Watch those skies. Stay well. Keep doing good things and sweet dreams. See you next week.